Good morning. I'm Peter Donalds in for Kathleen Dunn today. And we heard this week the news on Wednesday. Writer Kurt Vonnegut died as a result of injuries. He suffered a fall in his home a few weeks ago. So today we talk about the life and the work of Kurt Vonnegut. Of course, we welcome your calls, any comments or questions. You have a favorite passage, or if you have questions for our two guest experts today, please do give us a call as we spend the hour, as we should on this occasion, talking about the great Kurt Vonnegut. Our numbers, 800-486-8655. That's the toll-free number, as always. Again, 800-486-8655. The number here in Milwaukee, if you want to try the local number, is 414-227-2050. We welcome our guests, two of them. Jerry Klinkowitz is Professor of English and University Distinguished Scholar at the University of Northern Iowa and author of The Vonnegut Effect. And Todd Davis is Professor of English at Penn State Altoona, poet and author of several books, including Kurt Vonnegut's Crusade or How a Postmodern Harlequin Preached a New Kind of Humanism. Gentlemen, both, welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning.
Morning.
Jerry Klinkowitz, let's start with you. What did we lose this week? Kurt Vonnegut himself has said over the last couple of years that he had a full career. He was encouraged to do more writing, but he said, I've said it all. Did he? You think he said it all?
Well, he said it all, but it's going to be reread for years and years and years. He was very tired for about the last 10 years. All he wanted was to go home, go to sleep. And so even though I'm torn apart by his death, I'm hoping he at least is enjoying this piece he's wanted for so long.
Yeah. Well, you say you're torn apart by his death. Tell us about your relationship with Kurt Vonnegut as a writer and a fan.
Oh, it's been most of my life. Read him as a student at Marquette University back in the early 60s as an antidote to the Chaucer classes I was taking. I thought, if this is what being an English major is, Kurt Vonnegut, in addition to Chaucer, I think I'm in the right field. I'm happy that I was in on the ground floor for Vonnegut studies. It's sort of like knowing about the Beatles from Cavern Club days instead of from Ed Sullivan. But basically, I just grew up with his books and hopefully matured as a scholar by responding to them, which I've been doing for 40 years now.
Todd Davis, you had a personal relationship with Kurt Vonnegut?
I only did after my manuscript was accepted for publication by SUNY Press. I was a schoolboy growing up in the state of Indiana, and while I enjoyed sports, I also loved literature, and it's hard to find role models, in the state of Indiana at least, for the literary arts. And here was this figure, Kurt Vonnegut, whose books in junior high and high school we were passing around illicitly, giggling about, often puzzling over, quoting to one another. And when I went to write the work, and I think legacy is really what's on my mind today, Kurt Vonnegut's legacy and Jerry's legacy is one of the reasons that I went on to write about Vonnegut. I was at Northern Illinois University where Jerry started sort of all of Vonnegut studies, and three of the people there, Jim Millard, Susan Schreiber, and Glenn Meter, were people that were in on that ground floor too. And so that legacy led to me writing about Vonnegut. And once the manuscript was accepted, I didn't want to sully it before that. I sent it to Vonnegut, and the generosity of the man was astounding, and he's continued up until the time of his death, up until 3 weeks ago or so, sending me gifts, calling me, helping me along with my writing career. So,
I want to stay with you, Todd Davis, and ask you about the title of your book. You call him a new kind of he preached a new kind of humanism. That's something that occurred to me. He was an evangelist for humanism, wasn't he?
I certainly believe so. Certainly, he was postmodern in that approach to humanism, however. There wasn't the center on which we could build a foundation for humanism in Vonnegut's view, as there might have been for the high modernists, placing humanity right at the center and knowing there was some fixed center. Vonnegut talked often about comforting lies, about we make these things up. And so, in other words, like an evangelical religious person of any faith, he was putting faith that the best thing we could do is care for one another and care for this planet.
I want to play a short clip of Kurt Vonnegut. Let me see. This one is from a 2006 interview with NPR.
The trouble with being a secular humanist is that we don't have a congregation. We don't meet. So it's a very flimsy tribe. But, there's a wonderful quotation from Nietzsche. Nietzsche said, only a person of deep faith can afford the luxury of skepticism. It's something perfectly wonderful is going on. I do not doubt it. But the explanations I hear do not satisfy me.
Todd Davis, you want to comment on that?
Well, what I love about Vonnegut is that this kind of thinking, and he maps this out in his nonfiction book, Palm Sunday, goes back to his ancestors, the ancestors that came to America as skeptics, as German freethinkers. And so he says he came by his lack of faith and his skepticism, but his embrace of humanity and trying to comfort us as we get through this thing we call life, he came by it honestly.
Before we go to callers, Jerry Klinkowitz, let's go back to you. Could tell us a little bit about his early life and how that shaped his writing.
Well, his early life, like Todd says, was growing up in Indiana, which is, aside from growing up in Wisconsin, one of the most wholesome things you can do. He loved Midwestern values, embraced them, and professed them to the end of his life. Interesting things happened to him very early in life. First thing was he was born into a fairly comfortable, almost well-to-do family. His father was an architect. Uncles and aunts were civic cultural leaders in Indianapolis. People thought he would sail on to a career being a leading cultural or business figure in Indianapolis. Then the family lost everything in the Great Depression. Kaboom. Life changes. Next phase in his life, he serves as a combat soldier in World War II. Kaboom, he's captured, imprisoned in Dresden. Even worse, sees the city destroyed in a firestorm.
And this, of course, becomes the impetus for Slaughterhouse 5.
Exactly.
Why did it take him 25 years to write that novel?
He always claims he didn't have the words for it, didn't have the form for it. Actually, I think he needed for American culture to mature enough for it to be ready for it. In the 1950s, we were still reading modernist novels in which, as terrible that war was, there were still heroic figures. Ernest Hemingway might create a role. We all know how heroic Hemingway was, and that role would be played by John Wayne. I think it took until 1969 for Vonnegut to feel confident that the public would receive a book in which the soldiers were not John Wayne heroes. They were just boys, 18, 19-year-old children.
And Todd Davis, let's go back to you. I want to also mention he began, or part of his work was in science fiction, which to the casual fan might surprise them.
Yes, and he has an alter ego in many of his books, Kilgore Trout, which is sort of that failed and non-respected science fiction writer. Vonnegut, I would say, is less a science fiction writer than a futurist, someone who is looking just beyond the horizon to see what might happen based on the present circumstances. And so when he did get back from the war, he was working as a public relations writer at GAE, thanks to his brother's influence, a chemist. And this short story market, sci-fi, sold very well to these magazines. And so he's working in that. But I think ultimately it was less science fiction than futurists saying what might happen based on our present situation.
But he did have an affinity for it, even going back to it in later works, beyond just the early works.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah. As I say, Kilgore Trout will follow us through many of the books as that sort of failed sci-fi writer. And it allowed Vonnegut to have many brief plot outlines and jokes that ended with punchlines based on sci-fi plot setups.
Yeah, and speaking of jokes, we don't want to let this hour go by without spending some time on humor. Certainly, black humor was central to his work, Jerry Klinkowitz, wasn't it?
Absolutely central, and it certainly was black humor. One of Kurt's favorite jokes, which apparently is a true story, some terrible criminal was being executed down in Chicago in the Cook County Jail, and the warden says, you may speak your final words right now. And the criminal said, well, this will certainly teach me a lesson. But there was a sense of understanding how jokes worked. Vonnegut was a great comedian, but he was also a student of comedy. He said comedy releases tension. It's the catharsis of laughter, where maybe we're feeling great pain, but if we laugh, we feel better. And his example was, take a simple joke, like why is the cost of cream so high? And he says, the joker asks the audience this question. Well, the audience is tense. They don't know the answer. They feel they should know. They have to think to find the answer. That's hard work. So they're sitting there in this state of tension and finally say, well, gee, I don't know. Why is the cost of cream so high? And the joker says, it's because the cows really hate squatting over those little bottles. And you laugh, and the laughter is a relief. You feel better. You don't have to think. There is no hard and true answer to this.
Yeah, and as I read one of the accounts, one of the commentators in the last couple of days, the irony that very, very serious subjects would suddenly contain the very humorous passages, and then lighter topics, he would surprise us and give us some profound things to think about within a lighter context. You know, speaking of humor, before we go to break, I've got some cuts, and I want to hear some more of Kurt Vonnegut's voice. Here he is talking about humor.
There's a superficial sort of laughter. Bob Hope, for example, wasn't really a humorist. He was a comedian with very thin stuff, never mentioning anything troubling. I used to laugh my head off at Laurel and Hardy. There's terrible tragedy there somehow. These men are too sweet to survive in this world and are in terrible danger all the time. They could be so easily killed.
Of course, that wasn't Kurt Vonnegut. That was Norman Dietz, the narrator, but that was from A Man Without a Country, the 2005 collection of essays. Let's go to calls, and let's see. Jim is calling from Hudson. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good.
My comment is, and I'll ask it and then take my response off the telephone, is I've been a reader of Mark Twain for the last 25 or 30 years and collector, and also of Vonnegut's works, and obviously he was an incredible fan of Twain and influence. And I think people make the mistake when they say that, you know, both Vonnegut and Twain were not men of faith. They were incredible men of faith. They were not men of religion, and they took great exception to the standardized, formalized religious community and all of its dogmas and status quos that it tries to impose on society. But they had tremendous love and appreciation for a faithful world and the life that exists and nature and trees and whatnot. And I'd like to hear your comments on that, and I'll take it up there. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Todd Davis, you want to take
that
one?
One thing that Vonnegut sometimes is referred to himself as is a Christ-worshipping agnostic. He was a very faithful man in the sense of placing at that center, what can we do for one another in terms of comfort, in terms of food, medicine, housing, giving ourselves a sense of purpose through work. Player Piano, a dystopian work of fiction, is all about a world in which workers have been displaced, and they don't have any sense of meaning or purpose in their life. And so Vonnegut definitely looks in particular to the example of Christ, and he has said that he wished people were not clamoring to have the Ten Commandments placed on courthouse yards, but to have the Beatitudes placed there.
Yeah. Jerry Klinkowitz, anything to add to that?
Oh, I think Todd's got it exactly
right. I also read an account, or actually as I was listening to some audio clips, he talks about Karl Marx and the famous quote about religion being an opiate for the masses, and Kurt Vonnegut says that was misinterpreted by those who read it, that Marx had a respect for, at the time, opiate was used to relieve pain, and he said religion certainly can be a temporary relief of pain.
And it's a better relief than opium, which is the current opiate of the masses. Vonnegut, you know, he's a postmodernist, and not to get into theoretics, but just think, during the whole modern era, and including the first 10 years of Vonnegut's career when he had trouble finding a serious readership, modernism told us it's all meaninglessness. It's just nihilism. Vonnegut accepts that and says, okay, but now what do we do? And here's where you get his invention, and here's where you get the very special kind of faith that he has, which I agree is anything but a religion.
Right, right. Quick break, and then right back with our guests. We're talking with Jerry Klinkowitz of the University of Northern Iowa and Todd Davis, both authors of Vonnegut books. And we take your calls as well. Your questions, comments, welcome at 800-486-8655. I'm Peter Donalds in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about Kurt Vonnegut. This hour reports that we got the news on Wednesday. He died at age 84, and we should spend at least an hour talking about his life and work. Let's listen to this also. I believe this is also from Man Without a Country, not Kurt Vonnegut's voice, but a narrator doing a partially successful impression, but the words are his. Kurt Vonnegut from A Man Without a Country.
Socialism is no more an evil word than Christianity. Socialism no more prescribed Joseph Stalin and his secret police and shuttered churches than Christianity prescribed the Spanish Inquisition. Christianity and socialism alike, in fact, prescribe a society dedicated to the proposition that all men, women, and children are created equal and shall not starve.
Jerry Klinkowitz, care to comment on that quote from Man Without a Country?
Oh, it sounds like a lot of the many things that Vonnegut drew from other thinkers, such as Eugene Debs and so forth. Kurt was so touched when someone, even, you know, besides himself, who could come up with insights of that into humanity, because that's the hope we were talking about before the break. That's the in creation of your own sense of meaning that makes life livable, as opposed to having it imposed upon you from above.
Let's go to Sullivan and talk with Rich. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm sorry to say I have read neither of your guest books, but I certainly will look for them. My interest is Vonnegut and music. The first book I read of his was Player Piano, and I recognized that he touched on themes that Isaac Asimov had in some of his robot stories, and then later Freeman Dyson touched on the idea of music. And as far as I read Vonnegut, music was among, perhaps, the one proof of humanity that gave him some hope. And I really mourn the loss of Vonnegut. And to the Hudson caller, I just wanted to say that one of the great philosophers of Western culture, at least in flashes these days, is Craig Ferguson on Late Night TV, who tells his audiences a Vonnegut kind of idea. You cannot logically have faith and certainty. And that's, I think, what Vonnegut wrote about again and again, that you cannot act on faith as though it is a certainty, because it leads to the Spanish Inquisition and it leads to Joseph Stalin and those kinds of manifestations of humanity.
Rich, thanks very much for your call. Who wants to pick up on that? Todd?
Jerry speaking.
Okay.
Kurt loved music. One of the things, my last letter from him a couple months ago, we were talking about a completely unrelated issue, Frank Lloyd Wright, but he wound up saying, Frank Lloyd Wright, who, as we all know, loved music, classical music, created these symphonies of buildings with all the parts holding together like a work of music. And Kurt said, music, specifically American jazz, is what has kept me alive all of these years. He just delighted in music to the extent that you can do a Music of the Spheres interpretation of his work, and it holds up.
Todd Davis, what about that second point? He mentioned Craig Ferguson. Are there any Are there any modern writers or speakers or even comedians who are picking up from Vonnegut?
So you're speaking about contemporary writers?
Yes.
That might be.
Yeah.
In fact, this semester I'm teaching a course not only at Vonnegut seminars, I often do with first-year students here at Penn State. I'm also teaching a seminar on Sherman Alexie. And I honestly think Sherman Alexie it may be that next in line to take up the torch that Vonnegut has. One moment, deeply skeptical, deeply cynical about the situation in the United States, specifically for American Indians in the United States, the dark black humor to deal with that. But at the same time, a deep sentimentality, a deep belief that somehow we can touch one another in love and help each other to get through this. So I'd say Sherman Alexie would be one of those characters.
You mentioned sentimentality. In fact, for the critics that Vonnegut did have, that was one of probably his harshest criticisms, that he was over-sentimental.
Mm-hmm. And let's see, how to put this. Those critics are working out of a high modernist paradigm. And that high modernist paradigm is one that says art for art's sake, irony as the chief good. Vonnegut really makes that shift, that postmodern shift to, no, not art for art's sake, art as a potential agent for change. And at times, if it requires, after much misery perhaps in a novel, a platitude, something like Elliot Rosewater in the novel God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, in which he baptizes Mary Moody's twins and says, God damn it, you've got to be kind.
And notice how the times eventually catch up with Vonnegut. The anti-sentimentalist critics were tearing Vonnegut apart in the 70s and into the 80s. All of a sudden, it's the 1990s, and sentimentality is dignified again.
Mm-hmm.
We get a country crying its eyes out over The Bridges of Madison County by Bob Waller. We get Alice Walker's The Color Purple. We get John Irving, who was one of Kurt's students at the University of Iowa back in the 60s, writing The World According to Garp, and more and more sentimental works ever since. Like I say, it took some time for us to catch up with Vonnegut.
What else did the critics have to say, whether from the early period or up to our current times? What was the harshest criticism of Vonnegut? Was it the sentimentality issue?
He was too easy. Actually, it was very hard work that Vonnegut was doing. It's hard work to make it look easy, but people just went for the superficial ease for it.
And you had major writers like John Irving, who had been a student, or John Updike coming to Vonnegut's defense. And I think a true writer understands to make something look so simple, so easy, so approachable is actually darn hard work.
Todd can probably tell you about Vonnegut's composition method, how he wasn't a swooper, a basher. Todd,
oh,
you remember
yeah.
the comment on that?
You take it away, Jerry.
Okay. Vonnegut would write one page at a time, laboriously, you know, pecking it out on a manual typewriter to the very end. He was still using an old manual. He didn't even want an electric, let alone a computer. But he would work on one page for hours, and if it wouldn't work, he'd do it again. And he might have 17, 18 versions of a page before he would get on to page two. He said if someone would come into his workroom and look at what he had on the table, they'd think it was the workplace of a madman, because here was a stack of not novel pages, and he'd be on page 102, but there would be a dozen versions of page 102, because he wouldn't leave that page until he got it right.
Did he continue to write every day until the
end?
He
was mainly writing essays for a magazine called In Our Times. He was writing prefaces for books by friends, writing on occasion.
Yeah. Are there unpublished manuscripts or essays that we might hope to find or read someday?
I think hopefully someone will gather together the all of these scattered prefaces, because, you know, Lord knows where they would appear. Someone should take those prefaces. I like There's a book, a memoir about Hunter S. Thompson that came out earlier this year. Vonnegut wrote the preface to that, and I had that book on my desk for a week before I even noticed Kurt had done the preface. So someone's going to have to dig all these pieces up.
Yeah,
I know also in the state of Indiana, this year was a celebration, the year of Vonnegut. And part of the festivities later this month in April, Kurt was supposed to give a lecture at Butler University. And I guess it was only 4 weeks ago I talked to Kurt on the phone, and he had been working on that and felt that he had it where he wanted it to be. So, you know, I believe there will be these kinds of nonfiction pieces coming out.
Oh, yeah. That event, I'm told, will still happen, and his speech will be read by a guest speaker.
Wow. John is calling from Milwaukee. Let's talk to him. Hi, John.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I want to ask, you know, I never met Kurt Vonnegut, but he was horrified when Dresden got bombed by the Allies and when Hamburg got bombed by the Allies. But my question was he also horrified when Saddam Hussein bombed Halabja, and after he bombed it, he went and gassed it and killed 5,000 people, 3,000 of them were women and children. And after the Americans left Vietnam, the Viet Cong went and killed 2 million people, 2 million, more than what was killed in Hamburg or in Dresden. Was he horrified when the Viet Cong killed those 2 million people?
John, thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you.
Who wants to grab that?
Of course he was horrified. And the first question is, well, why didn't he speak out publicly on those acts? I would assume that he spoke out on the bombing of Dresden because it was his people, the Allies, who were responsible for it. I think Kurt Vonnegut would have wanted an Iraqi to speak out on the atrocities by Saddam Hussein. He would have wanted someone from North Vietnam to speak out on the atrocities in Vietnam.
Yeah, and I'll join in with this and take it in a little different direction, you know, because I've been painting this view of Vonnegut that he, and I think in some ways he was hopeful. And at the same time, at the start of Slaughterhouse 5, in the first chapter, you know, he's told by a movie producer, why write an anti-war book? You might as well write an anti-glacier book. Well, Vonnegut still does go ahead and write that anti-war book, despite perhaps that resignation that it may not make a difference. He had a dark view of humanity. And in a book like Galapagos, we get the devolution of the human species into some sort of seal-like creature. And picking up on the music comment earlier, his lament throughout that book is, we won't get Beethoven's Ninth Symphony again, because in this devolution, our brains become so small. But at the same time, we will not have ways to destroy the planet and to destroy each other through war. So Vonnegut also had this dark view that perhaps it would be best for us and the planet if we devolve into a way that we couldn't harm each other.
His dark view also pertained to environmentalism. When asked if he'd seen An Inconvenient Truth with Al Gore, he said he didn't need to see it. He knew all that already, and anyway, we're done for.
Well, he certainly had the dark view, and your quote from Galapagos is right to the point. But notice he doesn't just throw up his hands in despair. He comes up with, I think, a very amusing technique for talking about this devolution, the idea of humankind turning back into these little seals where we just have flippers so we can't make atomic bombs anymore. It's a good joke.
And I'd like to mention one thing. It's from Breakfast of Champions, because since I mentioned Kilgore Trout, Vonnegut has a drawing that he did himself in Breakfast of Champions of Kilgore Trout's headstone. And on the headstone, it says, "We are healthy only to the extent that our ideas are humane." And I'd see that as a fitting headstone for Vonnegut as well, that while he despaired seeing what we would do as human beings at times, he still did try to write towards a hopeful place, and his books are full of humane ideas.
There's another headstone, and I forget which book it's from, and it says, "Everything was beautiful and nothing hurt."
Slaughterhouse Five.
That's from Slaughterhouse Five. Yeah. Was that his? Was he writing his own epitaph with that one?
If you're asking me, I would say that is really more about what he wishes for us, not what in the end we experience.
Yeah, that's what I would think, because certainly we haven't talked about his depression at length yet. We probably should before the hour is out, but he certainly did suffer from depression. In fact, attempted suicide at one point in his life, right?
Well, getting back to that headstone for Kilgore Trout,
In
the novel Breakfast of Champions, Kilgore Trout wins a Nobel Prize eventually, but not in literature, in medicine, for the contribution of that humanity, that it is simply good for our health, not for our literary entertainment. And so I think in treating his own depression, Vonnegut considered this as a medical procedure.
You know, actually, we've got a clip of Vonnegut reading from Breakfast of Champions. I'm not sure what the clip is, but let's listen to it.
When Duane Hoover and Kilgore Trout met each other, their country was by far the richest and the most powerful country on the planet. It had most of the food and minerals and machinery, and it disciplined other countries by threatening to shoot big rockets at them or to drop things on them from airplanes. Most other countries didn't have doodly squat. Many of them weren't even inhabitable anymore. They had too many people and not enough space. They had sold everything that was any good, and there wasn't anything left to eat anymore, and still the people went on all the time. Thing was how babies were made. Everybody in America was supposed to grab whatever he could and hold on to it. Some Americans were very good at grabbing and holding, were fabulously well-to-do. Others couldn't get their hands on doodly squat.
So that's Kurt Vonnegut reading from Breakfast of Champions. Todd Davis, what do you think of that passage?
It's classic Vonnegut, and it ties back into his understanding of socialism, his understanding of the radical message of Christ in the Gospels.
And also it's kind of that sort of Upton Sinclair example of using fiction to advance a social critique.
Absolutely. And the way, and I love Breakfast of Champions, the narrative voice there, because it's this innocent voice. In other words, Vonnegut often looks at the world, and he's a very idealistic man, and as he often comments, those ideals come from his American civics class at Shortridge High School in Indianapolis, Indiana. And he's idealistic and innocent in the way a child would be. A child hasn't had the ability to come up with the very complex arguments for war or for the suffering of others because they don't have food or housing or medical care. Vonnegut kept that view that, no, you can come up with your adult, very complex explanations, but it still doesn't get that person out of suffering.
Let's take a short break. I do have some callers on the line, but there's room for you at 800-486-8655. That's the toll-free number. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 227-2050. Talking about Kurt Vonnegut this hour. I'm looking to see if I have any other cuts to play. I think we've played them all. I'm saving one from Slaughterhouse-Five. He's reading, and we'll play that in a little bit. But certainly more. We've got plenty of the hour left, so your calls are welcome. I'm Peter Donalds, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guests, Jerry Klinkowitz of University of Northern Iowa, author of The Vonnegut Effect, and Todd Davis, author Kurt Vonnegut's Crusade, or How a Postmodern Harlequin Preached a New Kind of Humanism, both with us for this hour as we give tribute to the life and the work of Kurt Vonnegut. He passed away on Wednesday this past week. Mike is on the line from Thiensville. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Peter, and thanks to your guests. I have to say that it's just wonderful to listen to this show. In particular, when I was in graduate school years ago and thinking about the leadership implications for the things that the topics that Kurt Vonnegut wrote about, in particular the player piano, what would it mean? What would be the implications for a school system in regard to jobs? Thinking about the social moral equity issues and God bless you, Mr. Rosewater. You know, folks who would learn to become rich by slurping at the river of money and the like. I think it informed a generation of leaders about thinking about what are the logical implications of policy matters in the present, looking on to the future.
Mike, thanks for your call. I'm going to drop your line because our guest is sharing it, so you can listen on the air. Is Mike right? Did Kurt Vonnegut, for all his success, did he influence leaders, or did he fail on that count? Jerry Klinkowitz.
Absolutely. I know a few of them. almost everybody a little younger than me who I bump into who knows anything about Vonnegut will not just say, oh, I've read his books, but they will say when they read them and how it changed their lives and how it's going to influence what they do with their careers. He's definitely an inspirational writer in the better sense of that cliche.
I guess what I'm asking, and I don't mean to be pessimistic about it, but is he set aside for sort of one camp, and maybe the other camp was influenced and they remember exactly when they read Ayn Rand, for example?
Vonnegut's readership seems a little broader than that. Like Todd was saying, yes, science fiction readers love him, but all sorts of readers who just despise science fiction love him too. His appeal is broader than any one camp. His camp is simply humanity.
Okay. Mark is calling from Hudson. Let's go there next. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I kind of echo the same thing the gentleman just said about player piano. I felt it was more relevant when I was in college than 1984, mainly because of the whole theory of the reeks and the wrecks, the reconstruction people and the wrecking people, and finding work for people. And also, God bless you, Mr. Rosewater, is one of my favorite books. So that's all I have to say.
Okay. Thanks for
calling.
Let's talk about Kurt Vonnegut as a performer. He was certainly out on the circuit making speeches. He was a popular commencement speaker in the tradition of Mark Twain, I guess, out in the public. How was he as a public performer, Todd Davis?
Splendid. He had fabulous timing. He was that comedian. And as Jerry said earlier, he knew how to set up a joke. He studied the art of joke telling. But of course, and I think this is the reason he gravitated toward those graduation speeches. This was a man whose entire collection of work has stayed in print. He was, as he often would like to say, you know, fabulously well-to-do in that sense. He didn't need the money to go do these speaking engagements at commencements. But he saw them as a way to really impact the world in ways maybe that his own fiction might not. Let me read you one quote from him. He says, this is from an interview, "I've worried some about why write books when presidents and senators and generals do not read them. And the university experience taught me a very good reason. You catch people before they become generals and senators and presidents, and you poison their minds with humanity, encourage them to make a better world." And I think that's what he was doing. He was setting down that challenge to graduates. What are you going to do with your life?
He really reveled in the idea that young people enjoyed his work, and as you said earlier, that you know we passed them around as teenagers. He loved that, didn't he?
Absolutely loved it. He went out to the public at great cost to himself. He didn't need the $8,000 or $10,000 from the speech. It would deplete him physically to do it, but he felt the obligation to go to his audience and show them that he cared about them, which in itself is a lesson.
Yeah. Let's see. Back to the phones. Charles is calling from Madison. Let's go there. Hi, Charles.
Hi.
You're on the air?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I was wondering what your guest and thought that Kurt Vonnegut would say about the completely unsubstantiated claim that a previous caller made that the Viet Cong murdered 2 million people at the end of the Vietnam War. Nobody's ever made that claim before. It's totally unsubstantiated. I'm sure Kurt Vonnegut would have replied to it immediately, as he was a very prominent anti-war voice at the time. And these kinds of claims are just typical of the propaganda that's being spewed over us now, which Vonnegut also pointed out was absurd nonsense. Why did both your guest and yourself sit there and let this man make a totally unsubstantiated claim? It was 2 million people died in Vietnam as a result of American action, which Vonnegut was very aware of.
I wonder if the caller was perhaps thinking of Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge.
Perhaps he was, but even in the case of Cambodia, that is an the Khmer Rouge were driven out of power not by the United States, but by the Vietnamese invading. The United States, at the end of the Vietnam War, became de facto allies of the Khmer Rouge, which is a well-known fact, and I'm sure Vonnegut knew that too.
Yeah. Well, Charles, if the three of us were remiss, I thank you very much for making the call and making the point.
Yeah, that's a pretty big mistake for you to make. Have you heard that claim by anyone before? I mean, I really don't think Vonnegut would have sat there like both of you did who are apparently very close to the man, and just let that go by.
Charles?
It was a complete fraudulent statement.
We got it. Thanks very much for the call. Kurt Vonnegut should be a better example to the three of us, I guess.
Well, of course. We're not Vonnegut.
No.
There's no way the three of us can represent him as hard as we're trying to do this morning.
Well, again, thanks for the call. And we go to Derek in Round Lake. Hi, Derek.
Yes. Good morning. Very interesting conversation. I just would like to salute the previous caller who just called. I think shows his courage and knowledge of the issue. One thing I'd like to say, with the death of Kurt Vonnegut, the great humanist, international humanist, I would say, his death also has proclaimed some death of the American conscience. In regards, we live in a society which is so atomized and is so desensitized by television, by the mass media that brings things to the lowest common denominator to shape us into the form of a witless consumer. He was the only outstanding voice who brought things from a much larger perspective, was able to formulate it in a form where everybody across the cultural divide, civilization divide, would be able to understand it, because he was a person that suffered a lot of pain in his life and is able to put it into the pages so everybody could simply understand and relate to it. And I really salute him for that.
Derek, thanks very much for your call. So it gets back to what we talked about earlier, the legacy that he leaves. Certainly his words are still with us, but Derek is concerned that something else died this week. Todd Davis?
Well, certainly a very public figure who spoke in a way that means so much in terms of our ethical positions in our culture. He is gone, but I do think his work lives on, and I'll just give an example again from my seminar here at Penn State University. One of the books that we deal with is Mother Night, a book that was written at the time that Ian Fleming was writing the James Bond series, and in which, because of the Cold War, we had a romantic affair with the idea of being a spy, of leading a double life. And Vonnegut, in the introduction to the reprint of the novel Mother Night, said this was one of his only story at that time that he knew the moral of. And he said the moral is, we are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that quote a couple of times over the last few days. Would you please say it again?
We are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be.
Yeah.
And what I say to students, and I think this is the kind of legacy Vonnegut can have, I say to students, we are encouraged in our culture to think what we do at our job is really not who we are. Who we are is all the time away from the job. Therefore, if we're in advertising and we are asked to do some kind of ad campaign that we individually find morally reprehensible, no, that's not us. Go ahead and do the job. Vonnegut seems to be saying no matter what you're doing, and I always encourage students to remember the bulk of their life will be spent, actually, the bulk of their waking hours will be spent at their job. You are what you pretend mm-hmm. to be. So be careful what you pretend to be.
Derek, in his question and comment, also mentioned television, and Kurt Vonnegut was no fan of television. I pulled out a couple of quotes here. One of the few good things about modern times, if you die horribly on television, you will not have died in vain. You will have entertained us. And the other, thanks to TV and for the convenience of TV, you can only be one of two kinds of human beings, either a liberal or a conservative. Those are both from In These Times, an article from May 10 by Kurt Vonnegut. So he was no fan of television. Was he a fan, Todd Davis, I guess not. You said earlier he still used an old-fashioned typewriter. I imagine he didn't have a PDA and a laptop and all the rest?
No, and in fact, one of the reasons he gave, and in this way he's very similar to a Kentucky novelist and essayist and poet, Wendell Berry. Vonnegut believed very firmly in not using email. Why? Well, he had to go down to the store. He had to buy stationery. He had to get an envelope. He had to walk to the post office and mail it. And he talked about all the people that were part of his life because of those actions. And, of course, that's the thing that technology often does. It takes us out of the human community, not into it. And Vonnegut studied anthropology at the University of Chicago and was influenced by the ideas of Dr. Robert Redfield about the folk society. And he has an entire novel, Slapstick, based on that. And that idea of we need to belong to extended family somehow. And he recognized in modern times with movement because of professions and technology, that might be impossible in certain ways, but couldn't we create some kind of artificial extended family community?
And with that, let's go to Madison and talk with Ray. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Hi. I wrote in a book about Vonnegut back in 72, and I'd like to say hi to Jerry. I don't know if you remember me or not. But
Ray Alderman, hi.
Hi. Very sad event. All I wanted to say is that at the time, Slaughterhouse 5 had just come out when I was writing. I had to stop and rewrite to take into account of that book. And I thought in that book, he had achieved a kind of balance that he always sought. And we could hear the two poles of the balance in the questions people were asking. He was always torn between excessive compassion and the pull to be detached in order to survive. And I thought in Slaughterhouse finally he found a balance between those things. But it was, of course, when you achieve balance, you have to keep seeking it all your life. It's not something that you could just rest at. In teaching that book in 72, when I did teach it, even earlier, it had a profound effect on many students. And it was a time when people were debating whether to participate in the Vietnam War, whether to go to Canada, whether stuff like that, and without waiting in any one particular direction, which was hard to do anyway, people took that book a lot to heart, as I did too.
Ray, thanks very much for your call. Before time runs out, I have one more cut I want to play. It's a couple of minutes of Kurt Vonnegut reading from Slaughterhouse 5. So let's listen.
The saucer was 100 feet in diameter, with portholes around its rim. The light from the portholes was a pulsing purple. The only noise it made was the owl song. It came down to hover over Billy and to enclose him in a cylinder of pulsing purple light. Now there was a sound of a seeming kiss as an airtight hatch in the bottom of the saucer was opened. Down snaked a ladder that was outlined in pretty lights like a Ferris wheel. Billy's will was paralyzed by a zap gun aimed at him from one of the portholes. It became imperative that he take hold of the bottom rung of the sinuous ladder, which he did. The rung was electrified, so that Billy's hand locked onto it hard. He was hauled into the airlock and machinery closed the bottom door. Only then did the ladder, wound onto a reel in the airlock, let him go. Only then did Billy's brain start working again. There were two peepholes inside the airlock, with yellow eyes pressed to them. There was a speaker on the wall. The Tralfamadorians had no voice boxes. They communicated telepathically. They were able to talk to Billy by means of a computer and a sort of electric organ which made every Earthling speech sound. "Welcome aboard, Mr. Pilgrim," said the loudspeaker. "Any questions?" Billy licked his lips, thought a while, inquired at last, "Why me?" "That is a very Earthling question to ask, Mr. Pilgrim. Why you? Why us, for that matter? Why anything? Because this moment simply is. Have you ever seen bugs trapped in amber?" "Yes," said Billy. In fact, he had a paperweight in his office, which was a blob of polished amber with three ladybugs embedded in it. "Well, here we are, Mr. Pilgrim, trapped in the amber of this moment. There is no why."
And in the last moment of the program here, just some final thoughts from each of you on that passage or on Slaughterhouse 5, his most famous work. Todd Davis?
I think I'd return us to that moment when we were asked what Vonnegut would have said in that moment, and the three of us might not have said those things.
Mm-hmm.
In that original, in the first chapter of Slaughterhouse 5, I think this is his response to any kind of atrocity in the world. And this is the quote: "I have told my sons that they are not under any circumstances to take part in massacres, and that the news of massacres of enemies is not to fill them with satisfaction or glee. I have also told them not to work for companies which make massacre machinery, and to express contempt for people who think we need machinery like that."
Jerome Klinkowitz, a final word?
Well, that's a good quote, and thank heavens we can quote it. Vonnegut always remains the best spokesman for his own work.
Yeah, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Take care. And I'm if I have time here, one last quote from Kurt Vonnegut. "When I think about my own death, I don't console myself with the idea that my descendants and my books and all that will live on. Anybody with any sense knows that the whole solar system will go up like a celluloid collar by and by. I honestly believe, though, that we are wrong to think that moments go away, never to be seen again. This moment and every moment lasts forever. And with that, I thank our guests. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right. That's it. I hope you enjoyed the program. I certainly did. Thanks very much to our guest. Jerry Klinkowitz is professor of English and University Distinguished Scholar at the University of Northern Iowa and the author of The Vonnegut Effect. Todd Davis, professor of English at Penn State Altoona, poet and author of several books, including Kurt Vonnegut's Crusade or How a Postmodern Harlequin Preached a New Kind of Humanism. And you know, let's go out with some Kurt Vonnegut words.
When Duane Hoover and Kilgore Trout met each other, their country was by far the richest and the most powerful country on the planet. It had most of the food and minerals and machinery, and it disciplined other countries by threatening to shoot big rockets at them or to drop things on them from airplanes. Most other countries didn't have doodly squat. Many of them weren't even inhabitable anymore. They had too many people and not enough space. They had sold everything that was any good, and there wasn't anything left to eat anymore, and still the people went on eating all the time. Eating was how babies were made. Everybody in America was supposed to grab whatever he could and hold on to it.